Blog Talk Radio.
King Street, DC Metropolitan News and Real Estate Information.
Great Wednesday. Welcome to King Street. I'm your host, King, where we discuss all news, relevant information concerning real estate investing, particularly in Baltimore City and the DMV, meaning D.C., Maryland, the Virginia area. Hope everybody is being safe and practicing the CDC suggested guidelines of staying home, washing your hands, and just practicing the social distancing that they recommend. Now, with that being said, we want to begin the show, starting off our gratitude moment. One of the things that we like to say as far as every day, I believe, should start off with what you're grateful for, what do you believe, and starting off with a moment of gratitude, I find has always led me down a path of having a great day. And that's why I begin my conversations, my emails, my texts with great, whatever day of the week it is. So with that being said, here's what I'm grateful for today. I'm grateful for my health. I'm grateful for my life. I'm grateful for my ability to see, hear, talk, run, breathe, stand, and have sound mind. I'm grateful for all the love and support from my friends and my family members. I'm grateful for another 24 hours on the day to pursue my goals and my purpose in life. And I'm grateful for the infinite possibilities that today may provide. So with that being said, we're off to another great show. Now, today's show, we're going to focus on why is now still a great time to invest in real estate in Baltimore City. You know, even though we're going through a coronavirus pandemic and we're locked down for pretty much most of the day, it's still a great opportunity. Actually, even more so, because if you're planning to invest in real estate, now's the time. Now, of course, some of the challenges you're going to face with your investing in real estate is going to definitely come down to access to capital and your ability to look at properties, vet properties, and then also make moves as far as making an offer on properties. So we're going to discuss some of those ways today's show. So I want to bring in my co-host who's going to be joining me on the King Street Show, Mr. Andre Smith. How you doing, Mr. Smith?
King, excellent, brother. Excellent. Blessed and highly favored. Glad to be here today, brother.
Absolutely. Glad to hear you. Hope you and your wife and your family are practicing the CDC's recommended guidelines and are safe and healthy.
Oh yeah, man. We're very grateful. Things are well. Man, we're learning new vocabularies. Social distance and sheltering in place. And so, yeah, man, we're just expanding our vocabulary.
All right, brother. So what are you grateful for this morning? Or this afternoon, we should say.
You know, King, I'm just grateful that we just have an opportunity today to build upon yesterday. You know, that, you know, it could have been another way. There's people that didn't wake this morning, right? There's people that woke this morning, but because of the ailments in their body, they wasn't able to rise up and they wasn't able to face the sun. And I'm just grateful that, you know, that the Lord kept me, right? And that today there's purpose in today. How do we know there's purpose? Because we're here. And so I'm grateful, you know, today to bring some sunshine to someone.
Absolutely, brother. Absolutely. You know, one of the things I was talking about is while now is still a great time to invest in real estate, even though your strategy has to change a little bit because of the fact, as you alluded to, we got to practice social distancing. We have to be in a position where we can't, you know, go out as or as difficult to go out and look at properties, but still move forth with planning your investment strategies, looking for properties online, but then more importantly, having a strategy or a plan for accessing capital. I still believe that the banks are going to be a little tighter going forth. That's my prediction. I hope I'm wrong with that, but I just can't see how the banks are going to continue to offer loans where they can't enforce getting the collections of their money. You know, so that's just my experience and thoughts there. Any thoughts on that you may have?
No, I think you're right, King. I think we've seen this before. We've seen it during the tech bubble burst. We've seen it during the meltdown of the real estate market in, you know, 2006 to 2008, depending on who you talk to. And what happened in those markets is there was a cool down period. So lenders had to basically readjust, guidelines changed. I mean, I think back to like, you know, the last real estate meltdown, and as a real estate broker, as a practitioner, you know, the way that I put food on the table or have put food on the table for the last 20 years was being able to sell, list, and develop real estate. And so it was a very daunting time when everything was shift. But the reality is we adjusted and we moved forward and the market got healthy again and there was buying opportunities even after, you know, when things looked so dismal. And so that's what I'd say about this is lenders are going to lend and there's going to be opportunities for purchasers to purchase. But will there be a cool down period where things will get recalibrated, things will get adjusted, new guidelines will come out for lenders, and it's going to be about risk assessment. So you're absolutely right. I think they'll take on less risk kind of in the onset of kind of weighing out this epidemic. I think they'll scrutinize a little higher. We're actually starting to see that now on deals that we have on the table. Lenders are coming back and renegotiating the terms, want higher credit scores and maybe more cash in the deal in terms of down payment or equity. And so we're going to see those things. But I also think that it's a great opportunity for real estate now to be able to position yourself to be able to take advantage of this shift in the market because there will be an increase in inventory, you know, through foreclosures and other assets that will become available. So I absolutely think you're right. It's not going to be business as usual. There's going to be an adjustment. But the investor who is quickly able to pivot, who sees this as an opportunity, not as a demise, will come out this much stronger on the other side.
Absolutely. Now, actually, you bring up a good question that I have, which is, what are you seeing from the lenders now when it comes to processing loans? Are they being a little more stringent with their application process? Are they buyers maybe in your assessment getting rejected more now than they would have been in the past? Or is there any significant changes you've seen at all that's maybe hasn't really come down the pike and they're still moving forth with their normal practices at this point?
Yeah, so that's a great question, King. What I would say is this is a fluid situation, meaning that it changes day by day, hour by hour, and even lender by lender, and region by region. Keep in mind that different parts of the country had maybe a less healthy real estate market kind of prior to pandemic. So you have to kind of take all those things in account. But yes, you are seeing lenders in some cases tightening up their guidelines where you had a buyer who with a, you know, 600 credit score or 620 credit score could qualify for an FHA loan, 4 weeks ago. But lender by lender, that may be a challenge right now. The lenders that I'm talking to and people in the financial circles are telling me that they think the landing spot is going to be somewhere around 640 to start. And keep in mind that the higher the credit score, the better your ability to negotiate rate and terms of the loan. And so we're just saying what the starting point will be. So think about that. We're shifting from an environment of a 600 or 620 to an environment of a 640. That's substantial. So there's a lot of people who may not qualify with these new terms and new conditions. And I think it's also important, King, to give kind of a full picture that we're not just looking at this in the vacuum, is there's several parties at the table. So you have your lender, who we would call the originator. So in this case, this could be Bank of America, it could be PNC, it could be, you know, you pick it. It could be any of those companies that provide mortgages. And then we have what's called a secondary market. And so this is what most lenders, most borrowers are not familiar with, the secondary market. And this is a market where you have investors who are buying and selling at any given time. And it's kind of like a stock market in a sense, where they're looking at loans in bundles. And so loans may have, it may be several hundred loans that's in what we call a tranche, that's in one tranche. And an investor is looking at purchasing that tranche of loans. So your one individual loan may be one of several loans, maybe even one of hundreds of loans that's in one tranche. And so that secondary market, that secondary investor, it has a risk tolerance. And he's saying, okay, based on this current environment, what is the chances that people may lose their job? What is the chances that people's income may change? What is the stability of the market as it relates to, you know, real estate and people's ability to earn a living? And that factors into their decision as to how many of those loans and how much risk they're willing to take on. And people may remember words like toxic loans were words that were being thrown around when the last market correction in 2006 and 2007, where there was a whole lot of loans that were bought on the secondary market, and then once the market conditions shifted, the lenders no longer wanted to back those types of loans, and so they kind of pulled the mat out from underneath of the companies that were originating the loans. And so I say that to say is, in this environment, I do see a shift with the originator, but I think the major shift is going to be, or what we've seen thus far, the major shift has been in the secondary market, in investors' willingness to buy certain types of loans that carries a higher risk now with the environment that we're currently dealing with the Corona-19.
Okay. Even when it comes down to again, I know this may just be a guess on your part, or maybe it's not, but just out of curiosity, home buyers even going for an FHA loan, you know, I know that, you know, FHA said that they don't set the criteria, the banks set the credit score, so to speak. You think that still may be a pros or challenge for them in that 640 landing spot as well?
Yeah, so I think you make a great point, King, which is the FHA provides guidelines. And so they're saying that if you were to originate this loan, or you were to give this loan as a bank to a borrower based on these guidelines that we've set forth under HUD, then we will back this loan. And so what FHA does is they become an insurer. So they're telling the lender, because if lenders were only lending the money without any insurance, then they would lend a lot less money because they wanted to protect themselves on the back end. But what the federal government says is, hey, listen, it's okay to go forth and lend and put more loans out into the marketplace, because if this borrower defaults, then we will come in and we will make you whole. So we'll come in with insurance from the federal government and make that lender whole if there's a default. So FHA's role is they produce these guidelines, but it's the lender who actually is going to make a determination who actually gets the funding. And the reason why it works that way is because it's the lender who's on the hook at the end of the day, right? So you may get the insurance, but the servicing of the loan and all the other things that go along with making that loan, taking that loan all the way through, the lender assumes the risk on that. So what you're going to have is the lenders adjusting their risk tolerance. So they're going to make the determination to say, okay, you know what, FHA's guideline says that this person is perfectly qualified for this loan. However, we're going to layer on another condition. That's what lenders call to say, yes, you're approved based on the guidelines, but our additional level of security as a lender is to say we want a 640 credit score. Guidelines might say, okay, you need to be employed on the same job or in the same industry without interruption for the last, say, 18 months, and I'm just pulling stuff out the air here. But the lender may say, well, we feel better with 24 months. So as long as they meet the minimum requirement of the guidelines, then FHA will still insure the loan. But in most cases, the lender are going to put additional conditions on that borrower so that they would feel comfortable if something was to happen as it relates to risk tolerance.
Now, I have a question that was sent to me by one of the Conscious Roundtable members asking about condos. And this question is really buying a condo right now in this particular market where you may have folks who, you know, and how condos work, where your condo association fee is predicated on how many people, you know, the occupancy, overall occupancy, and then, of course, how many people are actually paying the condo fee. So would you say that you would be a person that should be more careful buying a condo and during this particular pandemic with the uncertainty where things are going right now, or would you say that the risk of buying a condo is the same regardless of where we are right now? It's going to be the same risk, so they shouldn't be less nervous about moving forth on buying a condo right now.
Yeah, so that's a great point. I would say, King, it depends on your investment strategy, as in how long – is this a buy and hold scenario? So are you buying this condo and say you're retiring in the next 10 to 12 years and you're going to keep this in your portfolio as retirement income, something that you're going to make a positive cash flow on and then maybe sell when you get closer to retirement? Or is this a buy and flip? So is this something that you want to buy in the next, you know, 60 to 90 days, you'll get back on the market? So that would make a that will make a difference as to how you might want to proceed. If it's a buy and flip, then yes, you have to be very concerned with the default rate. And what you said is absolutely right. So you're buying into a shared community, and everyone has a responsibility to upkeep the community. So those condo fees that you pay every month covers the expenditures to run and operate the community. So if you have people who are in hardship, who aren't able to pay their condominium fees, then it brings down the revenue or operating budget within the condo association. So therefore, there may be deferred maintenance that may not go on, things that aren't kept up the way it's supposed to. But in addition to that, you alluded to delinquencies that also ties into, again, approvals, right? So depending on what type of financing you're getting, FHA has an approved list. And for you to be on the approved list, the deficiency rates have to be under a certain threshold. So most of it's around 12% or so. So they don't want a default rate over 12% in most cases for lenders to lend to borrowers to buy into the condo association. So those are considerations. If there are some financial issues going on within the condominium, one, you may not be able to purchase because your lender may disqualify that condominium because of the default rate. And then secondly, if it is something that you're purchasing for a buy and hold, it may not be as much of an issue, right? Because 10 to 12 years from now, it may be a totally different situation than it is right now. If you're only going to rent it and bring in income and you're not concerned about selling it here in the immediate, I would say it wouldn't be as much of a concern. But it's definitely something that when you get your condominium documents, I would pay close attention to what is that default rate, what are those infrastructure projects that they funded thus far or ones that haven't been funded because of the default rates, because that's going to speak to the condition of the property that you're actually buying as it relates to the overall community.
Now, would you pass on a condo if you're going to purchase a condo as a person who's going to live in it with intent? Not as a home buyer, but as an investment property that you're going to live in for maybe 5 or 6 years, and then eventually you're going to maybe give to your son or your daughter, let them take over the property. But you find out in doing your research, the condo documents that the association actually is about to file bankruptcy. Would that even though you like everything else about the condo, you like the location, you like the building. Well, with that fact that the association is filing bankruptcy, deterred you from moving forth on that particular condo?
Yeah, that would be a major concern. That may be a major concern because, as we mentioned before, those condo fees goes into that operation budget, and if that association can no longer pay their creditors and pay for the upkeep and the maintenance of the building, then at that point it's like a marriage, right? You are married to the other unit owners, and if someone doesn't have the ability to pay, that's going to adversely affect you. And so I would have to look very closely. I have to look very closely at that situation, and I would have to look very closely at that.
Okay, all right. So let's talk about some of the, to set the context for our listening audience, so they can get a better understanding of, you know, who you are in the context of your experience. Let's talk about some of the previous projects you worked on, and let's talk about one of the ones that I know you worked on with the Howard Theater. If you talk a little bit about kind of the history of that project, and what you could disclose from a context of what was involved with bringing some of the people together as a real estate broker, your position in that, and then overall kind of what happened as a result of years that it took to develop the building and kind of functionality of where the building is currently right now.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So just the backstory is the Howard Theater, for those who don't know, is the oldest theater in the country that was constructed for African-Americans. And so most people may say, well, what about the Apollo? Are you forgetting about the Apollo? The reality is the Apollo was not constructed for African-Americans. African-Americans later got the benefit of performing there, and some later even ownership, but that theater was not created or built or constructed for African-Americans, where it's different than the Howard Theater. The history is rich at the Howard Theater. You gotta think about during segregation, you would have all B.B. King and all the big performers would come downtown to Washington, D.C. and perform at the hotels for the whites. And then later that night, they would all come with what they call Black Broadway. They would come up to U Street, and they had so many clubs and juke joints on U Street, and Howard Theater was one of many of those. And so, unfortunately, over years, it had fallen in disrepair and just basically abandoned for many years. And so geographically, if you can think about, if you know Washington, D.C., you have the vibrant 14th Street corridor that's butted right up against Howard University. So some of the most affluent blacks in the country really was known to be there and around Howard Theater. That's where the social, economics, and the political, and all those things mixed together in that Howard University community. And it's a very self-sufficient community as it relates to being able to Freedmen's Hospital was just right down the corner. There was a hospital for blacks, and blacks all over the region came there. So it was a hub in so many ways, and music is just one example of the cultural things that at the epicenter that was right there at Howard Theater. So with that as a backstory, you can understand the importance of the history within that community. And so my business partner, which was Malik Ellis, he had a sister company to our real estate brokerage, which was Ellis Development. And Ellis Development was the lead developer on the Howard Theater project. Now, that was a great project for so many reasons, beyond the historical element, but being able to bring something that the community could really take pride in at a time where, you know, there's a lot of gentrification and different things that was going on within that area of Washington, D.C., that just made it very important as a community to be able to look to something to say that, you know, that was history that was going to maintain and be there for generations to come. And so that was about roughly a little less than a $20 million development project. and it was the rebirth of the Howard Theater, which put people in the community to work, which was awesome. And it was a beacon of light when that project came on board for a lot of people in the community, not only in that community, but people who had ties to Washington, D.C., around the country.
Absolutely, absolutely. I didn't realize that. That's a history lesson I just learned today, that it was the first black theater in the United States for blacks. That was something I did not know. The oldest. Yeah, that was something I did not know. So that's very interesting to hear that, you know, and thank you for sharing that. And I've been to the Howard Theater since it has, you know, been redeveloped, and it's a beautiful, beautiful theater. And actually, I definitely look forward to eventually hosting a show there that I want to bring, because I love the way it was set up, and with the stage, the way it's positioned, and the dance floor, then you have the bar behind the stage. I mean, that's behind the dance floor, the seating area. I think it's a great location. And then the way they have the seats that you can look down onto the main floor as well. So I just think it's the way it's designed, I think it's very interesting.
Yeah, so that's to your point, King, is we had some phenomenal architects and engineers and advisors who worked on the project. But a lot of that design, really, it's a historical building. And so because it's a historical building, there were limitations in what we could and couldn't do as it related to the construction. And so a lot of what you see is the way it would have been in its heyday, even the position of the stage. So that's a tribute to the vision of the people who actually went into the design and the creation of it years and years ago.
Absolutely. So we have a caller that just called in to King Street. So I want to find out, I want to welcome my caller to King Street. So caller, welcome to King Street. Who are we speaking with?
Hi, you're speaking with Morgan.
Morgan, how you doing, Morgan?
Finding yourself.
Doing great. Did you have a question or a comment that were about real estate, investing in real estate, home ownership, anything along those lines?
Yes, I actually had a question about short sale. I wanted to know what are the pros and cons when it comes to short sale.
Okay, what are the pros and cons when it comes to short sale? It depends on that answer that would depend on what your position in the short sale is. In other words, if you are the property owner doing a short sales, doing a short sale, then there's pros and cons associated with it. And if you are the actual investor who's buying the property via short sale, then there's pros and cons associated with it. So I'll go ahead and take a shot at it and let Mr. Smith chime in as well. So I'll take it from the context of being I'm the property owner. So if you're the property owner, meaning that you own the property and you're doing a short sale. So first let me define what a short sale is for our listening audience. A short sale is basically if you owe a mortgage on a property, and because of the market condition and the property condition, the value as far as the market value of the property is lower than what your mortgage value is. So let's say, for example, that your mortgage is $150,000 on a property, but the market condition or the property condition says your property is worth $100,000, meaning that's the most someone's willing to pay you, then in order for you to sell it for less than what you owe, you have to get the bank's permission in order to sell it. And hence the title short sale. So the bank has to give the final authorization to say if they're going to allow you to sell it for $100,000 or anything lower than the $150,000, they have to approve it. Now, if you're the owner of that property, now some of the pros, we start with that, is one of the pros is you can avoid foreclosure, having the bank take the property from you. I mean, not foreclosure, I mean, you can avoid having them actually auction the property off from you. So if they take the property back through the auction process, then the banks will typically come after you for what's called deficiency judgment. And that means with the property sold for at the auction, the difference between what you owe the bank and what it sold for. So let's say, for example, you didn't do a short sale and the bank did a foreclosure on the property, took the property back from you at an auction, and they was only able to sell the property at $80,000. So now you owe $150,000. It is a $70,000 deficiency judgment. The banks at that point can then come after you and sue you for that. That's one option they can do. Another option they can do is if they sue you, that's going to stay on your credit report forever, and you can never really get that off. And Mr. Smith may have some ideas about that, but from a context of my experience, it's not easy to get that off. You eventually have to pay it. Now, a way to a pro, as I was saying, is if you do a short sale, which means you find a buyer who's willing to come on and buy the property from you for, again, whether it's $100,000 or whether that's $70,000, either way, then one of the pros is that in negotiating that short sale, the person who's doing negotiation can request that the bank does not sue you for that money, but actually have that money sent back as, or have the bank report to the IRS 1099 you, which means they call it additional income, to say that you actually were you generated $70,000 or $50,000 worth of property. So whatever the deficiency is, that was awarded to you as additional income that year. And then at that point, if you truly had a hardship, which is the reason why you're doing a short sale to get the bank to approve it, you can actually talk to your accountant. And again, I'm not an accountant, and it's something you would have to talk to an accountant about. But in my experience in doing short sales, if you talk to an accountant, if you truly have a hardship, then the accountant can report to the IRS that 1099 that the bank sent you, that $50,000 additional income was not really income. It came as a result of a short sale of a property, and that you had a hardship, and it explains what that hardship was, whether it was loss of a job, loss of additional income, or whatever it was that you could no longer afford the property. And then that negotiation that the accountant can do with the IRS can significantly or remove that additional debt. So you can walk away without owning anything at all. So that could be a pro of doing a short sale. Now, again, a con can be of doing a short sale is pretty much adverse to that, whereas you have someone who's negotiating a short sale who's not doing it in your best interest as a property owner, and they only represent the seller or the purchaser, the buyer, then in that case, they're not going to negotiate on the bank how the short sale is going to impact you. They're only negotiating the short sale as it impacts the for the benefit of the purchaser. And so, again, you still could be sued and still go through that same issue. So it's really the kind, I would say, from my perspective, if you're the property owner, is if you don't have a short sale negotiator who's representing you and has your best interest to make sure how after the short sale happens, you don't get adversely impacted by the property being sold or auctioned off. Any thoughts you might want to add to that as well, Mr. Smith?
No, I think you hit it. You hit it out the park. In Maryland, the good news is the deficiency judgment is not so much an issue. Maryland's legislator was wise enough to make that law in Maryland. However, what you said is correct, is the lender may, which is the reason why to think about short sales as a very legal, complicated real estate financial transaction. And it's not one size fit all. But as you say, they could 1099 you for the difference between you know, what you owe and what the property sells for, and ask you, I'm sorry, the difference between what you owe the lender and what the property sells for, they could 1099 you and have you actualize that in terms of income. So I would definitely say to get an accountant involved early in the process.
Absolutely. So that, does that answer your question, Morgan?
Yes, it does. Thank you.
Thank you for calling into the show,
Morgan,
as well.
All right. Bye-bye.
Yeah, so that was a good question. I think a lot of people really need to understand, you know, because short sales can definitely be used from an investment standpoint. As investors, people prey on homeowners who are behind on their mortgage and come to them with that as a possible solution. And, again, from my experience, they don't represent the buyer or the property owner very well in that context. And then they make sure that they get a property or a good deal by purchasing from the bank, but then they leave the property owner high and dry with dealing with the the deficiency statement on their own. But like you said, because Maryland passed that law where the banks can't sue you as much, but that 1099 can definitely add a tax burden to that person going into the next tax year. So definitely how they deal with that is going to be critical and key.
Yeah, good point.
Now, one of the questions I had prior to getting into the short sale discussion was, I know that you are currently, or you had worked on another kind of community development project similar to the ones that we're going to be working on here in Baltimore, where, you know, our policy or our strategy, I should say, with the roundtable is buying the blocks of properties and, you know, approaching it from a context. And when you're talking about buying a block of property, obviously you're going to be concerned about multiple blocks in that particular area, which now means that it's more of a community thought process. And so now we got to talk to community leaders, get their approval, got to understand what the master plan, you know, all those things. So with that being said, I know you have experience in doing that down in the D.C. and Prince George's County areas. So is there any particular community project that you worked on or in process of working on that you want to share with our listening audience today?
Yeah, no, King, there's a couple actually exciting projects that we're working on, but none is more, I guess, representative of what you said in terms of the community efforts, the economic impact, the jobs, the stability, the pride that people can have in their community when development activity kind of shows up. And the Suitland County Center kind of encompasses that. You got to think about this. In Prince George's County, they have more of the – they have the highest rate of underused metro centers in the region. And so when you look at Northern Virginia and you look at Montgomery County and some of the other municipalities, they have used metro centers as a launch pad for development because they say, hey, if people are able to walk to their jobs, if people are able to walk to the store and you can create these walkable communities, then in essence, you can solve a lot of problems as it relates to pollution and overcrowding on the streets. But also you can create a sense of community in a town center or a town square. And so the Suitland Town Center project was exactly that. This was a project that, and I got to be honest with you, when we were involved early on in the process, part of our job was to meet with community leaders, government leaders, and government officials, but also to get feedback from the community. And it was surprising because we were talking to the community about bringing 1 million square feet of mixed-use development to their community. Like, we're talking 900 apartments. We're talking about townhouses. We're talking about over 100,000 square foot of commercial retail space and a performing arts center and all these exciting things. But the reality is the community said, hey, we've heard this so many times. There's been so many different developers or so many people that's come in and made us these promises for the last, you know, 10 to 15 years is we don't believe it's going to happen. And so there's nothing that makes me more proud than to go now to see the project coming up out of the ground and to see the townhouses and the excitement. You know, there's over 1,200 jobs that's going to be made available through construction. We're talking about a huge project, a $400 million construction project in the heart of Prince George's County, just across the street from one a large federal agency. In the Census Bureau and right next to a metro station. So it's going to be a launch pad for so many other wonderful things that's going to happen to Suitland. And when we broke ground on that project, it was the largest redevelopment project in the state of Maryland.
Wow.
At that time. And so we were hired by the Redevelopment Authority. Our firm was hired at the Redevelopment Authority, and I was the managing broker of the firm. And we were hired to be the chief, really to serve as a development consultant directly to the county agency. So this was a different type of project in the sense that the county actually owned, the county government actually acquired the land, and they own the land, but the county's not a developer. And so we brought our team and skill sets to the table to help them through the entitlement process and to vet other service providers on the deal, so the architects, the engineers, the townhouse developer, and all the other various components of it. So, yeah, that's a project that we take a lot of pride in, was very fortunate to be involved in, but more importantly, just excited about what that's going to do to the overall community in terms of other economic projects that's going to spur because of that. And if I could, just to tie in the project that we're talking about at Suitland, the town square at Suitland Federal Center and the Howard Theater, is that's exactly what happened at the Howard Theater, is that once that project went up, then you started to see condominium sales. You started to see other redevelopment projects, and United Negro College Fund relocated from Northern Virginia to a Class A office building that was part of the extension of the project. Outdoor cafes and restaurants just started to pop up in the community because of the economic prowess that happened because of the town center. And we envision, or we actually see evidence of that actually happening in Suitland, just as it did at the Howard Theater.
Absolutely. Now, what would you say is that it took from a time standpoint to kind of, you know, before ground? I think one of the things that most people underestimate in real estate is the amount of time it takes to get development projects going. So a lot of people come in with that microwave mentality that's taught to them by these local gurus and real estate groups that teach them real estate investing. And then when they try to move up in the world, or they try to take on a bigger project than just one house at a time, they realize that there's time involved with that. So how long did it take before you actually broke ground on that project to get to that part? How many meetings,
yes.
How much time and effort was put into it, would you say?
Hours and hours upon hours. I think we were contractually, it was probably 2013 that we partnered with the county. So I think our award was 2013. We didn't break ground until 2017. So that was 4 years later. So that was 4 years of meetings. There was a lot of research that went into it. We had to understand the master plan for the community, for the area. How would our plan affect the master plan? So we had to take into account this 10 to 15 to 20 year master plan for that particular area, and say, and then shape our project in such a way that we were able to satisfy many of the different triggers and requirements. So we're looking at density, we're looking at traffic flow, we're looking at architect, engineer. There's a whole lot of considerations that go into a project of this scale. There's a lot of meetings, so you have to meet with the zoning board, right? Does this project comply with the existing zoning? Do you have to get a special special conditions, right? So that's a consideration. Then it has to be funded, right? So you have to go as it relates to being funded. This particular project, there was seed money that was started by the county, but then it went to a referendum. And so the people actually had an opportunity to vote on these types of development projects, large-scale development projects, to vote to see if they wanted their tax money to be steered towards these types of development projects. So that happened. But, yeah, it takes a number of years of meeting with officials, community stakeholders, and all the other components. You have to keep in mind that there's a federal interest here, because there's a federal agency that's just within 100 yards from the project. So there's consideration there in terms of security and access and all those other things. So there were high-level meetings with the federal government to understand the project, the impact of the project, but also the benefit of the project. Because you had a federal agency where their workers went from the mass transit into the building, and then when it was time to leave, exit the building onto the mass transit. So the challenge there is you had hundreds of thousands of people that was coming into this community every day, but they weren't contributing economically to the community. And so we had to do some surveys to say, what would it take for you to spend your lunch hour in the community versus at the cafeteria that's provided inside of this government insulation? So we had to take that into account, as what type of restaurants, what type of retail did the community, as well as the federal government, wanted to see, so that then these two concerns can be meshed. So, yes, a lot of meetings, a lot of discussions. And so, as you say, 13 contracted, 17 groundbreaking, and it wasn't until 19 that we actually had evidence coming out of the ground. So it wasn't until fourth quarter of 19 that the first phase in terms of the townhouses actually went up. And that's just one out of three planned phases. So we're really talking about a project, once it sunsets, we're talking probably 11 to 15 years.
Now, of course, you got paid on that project all that time. From the minute you got from 2013 to 2019, right? You made a lot of money doing that process, of course, right?
Yeah, you would think so, right? But yet, no, that is the goal. That is the goal, is to provide consultancy services, which we take very serious. And there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of hours that's spent developing this, but it is a labor of love. We have a phenomenal team of advisors that we've worked closely with. And as I said, I was the managing partner and the broker of the firm who won the award to be able to consult with the government to do the project. But not by any means was that just our firm. You know, we worked with a lot of very talented people to bring that to pass.
Absolutely. And that's definitely a wonderful project. And talk a little bit about the community itself, so our listening audience who may not be familiar with Suitland, from a demographic standpoint, from an income standpoint, so they can get an understanding of what the community looks like, and so what this kind of project would has done or will do for the community.
Yeah, so great point. Is Suitland is a it's a mixed community in terms of social and economics. It's a older community. It's one of the older communities in Prince George's County, in the sense when we look at housing stock. But it's also a community that hasn't had a major development project in probably 12 years. And the last major development project was a shopping center. It was a much needed shopping center because it brought a grocery store and some other conveniences. But my point here is you have a very vibrant community with its proximity to Washington, D.C., a lot of people working in and around the federal government. It's, you know, within a couple miles from the Air Force Base where the president lands. And so there is a lot of great things that happen in that community, but it just needed a boost in terms of socially, economically. And I think what we were talking about last week is relevant here as well, is you say, well, what communities tend to be ones that take off and the ones that tend to be left behind? And I think the ones with a plan and a communication plan, as well as a development plan. So talking to the elected officials and talking to other stakeholders within the community is vital as it relates to how quickly these projects move and how quickly they scale.
Absolutely. And now we're reaching there at the top of the hour, pretty much 10 minutes left in the show. And I kind of want to shift our conversation over to how business owners, entrepreneurs, whether you are a real estate investor, developer, or interested in getting into the business, what the mindset needs to be in this mode. And I want to shift here because I want to preface this by saying that I signed up for, I don't know if you're familiar with MasterClass. MasterClass is a, some guys created this online platform and went out and interviewed some of the giants in their particular industry, you know, whether it's writing, whether it's cooking, whether it's interior design, whether it's science, critical thinking, you know, basketball, like Stephen Curry for basketball, you know, Serena Williams for tennis. And they basically are doing a class where you actually get to hear the actual person who is the subject matter expert, talk about what they did to get where they are. And so I actually watched a course on critical thinking by Neil deGrasse Tyson, the astrophysicist, the brother who is known as, looked upon as one of the five smartest men in the world, if not the smartest man right now, today's when it comes to just understanding astrophysics, the universe, things of that nature, and those discussions. And my point is, now his course was on critical thinking, which why I signed up for his course. And one of the key things he pointed out was the importance of preparation. He says that he's been interviewed a million times on different talk shows, YouTube shows, his own show, and people are blown away at his level of knowledge as it relates to his ability to talk in depth about different subjects. And where I'm going with that is, he says that he prepares for that. It's not that he walks in off the top of his head and just speaks because he has the knowledge. He has to sit down and he prepares. So he goes through a period of writing out his speeches, making sure that he understands clearly his talking points and be able to quote sources. So the preparation, I believe, is key, is where I'm going from. I went to the context for that. So what suggestions would you say for, or do you have for investors, business owners right now, throughout this pandemic? How should they be preparing for when things change, when they can get the opportunity to get back out and look at properties or even engage in transactions, even right now? What tips would you recommend that they need to be doing to mentally prepare themselves for those conversations, for those negotiations, and for their research?
Yeah, awesome. So King, I would say Marshall Faulk, who I know is a good friend of yours, the Hall of Fame football player. I know that you guys are working on some affordable housing initiatives and some other things there in Baltimore City, and he said something that I have just haven't been able to shake since, and I've been really kind of engrossing myself in this concept that he mentioned, which he called, you know, he said, we got to always be chasing the cash. And so when you say case chasing the cash, you know, right away what comes to mind is C-A-S-H, right?
Right.
But he spells cash K-A-S-H. And he says that we got to constantly be chasing, and cash is an acronym. And so the K in cash stands for knowledge. So we got to be constantly chasing knowledge, right? So now during this time, this pandemic, is an excellent opportunity to get knowledge. There's so many different resources. You can get access to books and videos and those things even online through libraries and, you know, TED Talks. And there's just a wealth of knowledge out there that right now you should be just you should be a sponge right now. The second the A in cash stands for attitude, right? So this is a great time to adjust our attitude in the sense that if COVID-19 hasn't done anything else, it told us there's some things that we can't control. And so what we should be focused on, or what we need to be focused on in this time, is the things that we can control, and that is our attitude. What is going to be my approach? I may not be able to control what's going on, but what is going to be my attitude towards what's going on? How am I going to use my time, my resources, my knowledge, right, to better my situation and my community situation as I come out of this? The S in cash stands for skills, right? What skills are going to be required? Not today, not tomorrow, but next year, 10 years from now, 20 years from now. This pandemic has changed the way that we are going to do business for decades to come. Are you going to be on the front line in terms of acquiring the skills that is required so that you can be a subject matter expert or a focal point as to where we're going, not where we are? And the last is one of the hardest. The H in cash stands for habits. And habits is just simply consistently doing something consistently over and over again. That's the hardest part of success. Success is boring. Success is monotonous. Success, people think about success in the sense that, you know, it's just totally different. It's just totally different than what people really think. Success is really taking small actions and doing them consistently until you see results. What I really want to say is, once I see results, then I'm going to be successful. but it doesn't happen that way. And so habits is just continually to do things as monotonous as they may seem, but understand that what I'm doing today is going to build my tomorrow. I have a mantra that I've been saying for about the last 20 years, King, and it speaks to habits. And it's the life I live today is a result of the choices I made yesterday. Today's choices is the life that I choose to create. And today I choose to be great. See, that's what habits are. Habits is understanding that I may not have everything I want today, but I have everything I need to make tomorrow better than today. And so we might wake up today and say, oh, my God, I should have already been here. I should have had 20 investment properties by now. I should have 30 investment properties. I'm 10 years away from retirement. I should have $2 million in the bank account. The reality is today it is what it is. So first of all, I have to acknowledge that and take ownership of that. Is I made some decisions yesterday that led to my today's situation. But where I get excited at, King, is the hope that I can make some decisions today that will change my tomorrow. But the only way that's going to happen is I seek knowledge. The only way that's going to happen is I adjust my attitude. The only way that's going to happen is I acquire the skills that's going to be in demand in the marketplace. And the only way that's going to happen is I systematically create habits that's going to get me to where I want to be.
Absolutely. Those are profound words there. You know, I love the mantra. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, I tell folks that what you're feeding your mind, just as importantly as what you're feeding your body right now, where you're not being able to be as active as you normally were, is critical to how your future is going to pan out. You know, so if you're just in chill mode all the time, watching TV, watching entertainment things, you know, things that entertain you only, then you're going to be in a certain position when this whole thing breaks of not being able to capitalize on that needed time that you could have been using to educate yourself. I'm not saying that folks should not take time off to just chill and relax, because I think that time is important. And even though I'm a person that's an entrepreneur who believes, and I've always stated that as an entrepreneur, that I don't get days off, I get hours off, you know, and I've learned that talking, you know, Dr. Ronnie, that's not healthy. That's not living a wellness lifestyle, you know, which Marshall is going to be a part of that whole thing. We build out with that. But I think what you're saying is critical is find that balance. You know, one of the people who I'm studying right now, a guy named by the name of Brandon Bouchard, he talks about what he does throughout his day. And one thing he does is he says he works in chunks.
Mm-hmm.
And say he works in basically 90-minute chunks. He sits down.
Mm-hmm.
He's works for the hard 90 minutes, then he gets up. He goes to do something. Maybe it's to, you know, do some exercise, calisthenics, or maybe it's to go meditate, or maybe just take a short walk. It's something, but he doesn't just work for 4 hours straight, sitting at home just doing, you know, that continuous grind, like most people think. He gives himself that so he can refuel, recharge, let his brain, detox for a minute, and then he picks it back up. And throughout that day, he's put in 5 hardcore hours that way. And if you look at it this way, you consistently put out 5 hours every single day consistently at work, you're going to produce some results. As opposed to spending 8 hours and trying to figure out busy work during that time frame.
No, that's absolutely right. And also what you'll find, King, I've been doing that, not that way exactly, but something similar to that over the last 5 years. And what I find, King, is you're so much more focused and productive when you know that you're only getting it in for an hour. You're only getting it in for 2 hours, 3 hours. So you have less interruptions. It's funny, though, because if someone calls my phone, now if I just take them on as a client, you know, they take a back at it first, and it almost becomes a joke. Because when you call my phone, I'm very intentional. I'll tell you that I'm not available right now, but then I tell them when I will be available. So I set an expectation that I will call back within this time frame. And so now what I do is I set an expectation and say, you don't have to call me 6 times between now and the time that I'm going to return phone calls. The expectation is I'll return the phone call in that window, right? And so that's you're so much more focused when you do that. And I'm going to give just one tip, King, because so many people are just overwhelmed with everything that's going on. And when I talk about attitude, the one thing that we can do, something small, and I did this myself. I looked at my bank account, and I looked at, and this is after the pandemic, and I looked at how many subscriptions I had, things that I wasn't reading, things I wasn't staying up with, things I had even forgotten that I had the subscription, CRMs and Web Zoom, just things that I had that I wasn't using. And so in the matter of 20 minutes, I was able to recoup about $250 a month. So yours may not be that extreme. It may be just $10 a month or $15 a month. But my point here, King, is oftentimes we say we need more. I need more revenue. I need more income in these times. But I think if we're able to reappropriate what we have, change our criteria and priorities, I think that there's a lot that we have more than what we realize that's right in front of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think profound words of wisdom. I think it's definitely something we can leave our listening audience with, something they can build on, and that's the purpose of the King Street Show, is to give people relevant information as it relates to real estate investing, business, but more importantly, tips about how to get your mind focused and be on the right path. So as we close out today's show, Mr. Smith, did you want to give your contact information to our listening audience?
Oh, sure, absolutely. So they can visit me on my website, which is the Velocity Group LLC.com, the Velocity Group LLC.com. You'll be able to see some of the projects that we're going on there. You can also get me by email at Andre, A-N-D-R-E, dot your realtor, YourRealtor, at gmail.com. And I look forward to hearing from you again. As always, if you have any projects, things that need to be developed, looking for consulting services, just someone to partner with you, help you, mentor you through projects, we're absolutely available and looking forward to hearing from you.
Absolutely. And for our listening audience, of course, go to theconsciousrt.com to learn about what the Conscious Roundtable is building, what we're working on, and how you can get information. And we're going to be posting our classes that we're going to be launching on real estate investing, real estate development, and then business development in general. So again, I want everybody a safe and healthy rest of their Wednesday. Look forward to connecting with you all next week. Until then, let's all be more conscious, and let's all look for better ways to serve. Thank you.